These are great corporate finance quizzes. Could you put them in my office when you get a chance to? So that sure. It's corporate finance.
The usual rules apply, and the quizzes, I'll grade them. I'll let you know when they're graded. You can come pick them up. The solutions will be posted when they're done grade, when I'm done grading them. I do have three quizzes I gave today. It's first in, first out. So I'm going to grade the corporate finance quizzes that I gave this morning first, and then I will turn my attention to you and then the undergraduate evaluation. So if it takes a little later than usual, it's because I'm getting the corporate finance quizzes out of the way. So today I want to wrap up intrinsic valuation. I can't find my remote, it's gone somewhere, but I'm sure I'll find it one of these days. So let's take up where we left off the last class. We were talking about valuing banks. And I said with banks, you're making a Faustian bargain. Faustian bargain in the sense you don't know much about the bank. The bank financials are opaque. You have no idea what's going on behind. But you accept it because you say the regulators must be doing their job. And I think I left you with the point that we no longer trust regulators. And when we say we collectively, we as investors, we as depositors, and this isn't just SVB, this traces back to 2008. And if you don't trust regulators and you don't trust banks to be run by sensible people, you can no longer just discount dividends. Everybody get that intuition? Because when you discount dividends, you are trusting. You're trusting managers to pay out what they can afford to. You're trusting regulators to keep risk in line. So in 2009, I started rethinking the way I value banks. I said, I can't discount dividends. It's not working for me anymore. I have to estimate cash flows, but I ran into a brick wall. And the brick wall was the traditional way in which we estimate cash flows. Now, even if it's cash flows to equity, that's all you can focus on. Just net income plus depreciation minus CapEx minus change in working capital does not work for a bank or any financial service firm. For a very simple reason. What's depreciation for a bank, right? What do you depreciate? What's CapEx for a bank? It's not like you're making, and what is working capital? In some sense, everything is working capital and nothing is working capital, right? Every item is a financial asset or a financial liability. So the way I decided to rethink this was I said, okay, I have to rethink what reinvestment for a bank is. And anytime I have a question about reinvestment, the way I like to think about it is, for a bank to grow, what does it have to invest in? You might say it has to build more branches, but that's a very 20th century view of a bank, right? And when was the last time you actually walked into a physical bank branch? For me, it's like 12 years ago. Why would I want to go in there? What exactly am I going to get from a bank teller that I couldn't get from an ATM or do online? So it's not physical investment. But if you think about what banks need to do to grow is they need to maintain a regulatory capital ratio. What does that mean? They need to bring in equity or, you know, there are various definitions of regulatory capital, but some amount of equity. So if you're a growing bank, you have to bring in more regulatory capital. If you're a bank in trouble, what does that mean if you're in trouble? You're taking a big loss. So you've had multiple losses. You have a fine imposed on you. Then you're again regulatory capital poor. To keep going as a bank, you got to make up that deficit. So I decided that the way to think about reinvestment for a bank is to think of how much will this bank need to invest in regulatory capital to keep going as a bank, because I'm assuming it's a going concern, and to grow if that's what I'm putting in. So my definition of free cash flow equity for a bank is to start with net income and subtract out whatever I have to invest in regulatory capital. So let's think about what this will mean. You take two banks, they have the same projected net income, but one is an undercapitalized bank and the other is an overcapitalized bank. The way it'll show up is the undercapitalized bank will have to reinvest more to get to a point of being healthy, which means I'll have less cash flows to pay out. It should pay out less. So even if the managers refuse to acknowledge reality, I'm going to estimate a free cash flow to equity that reflects how undercapitalized you are. If you're a growing bank, you'll have less to pay out. Why? Because to grow, you got to reinvest more in regulatory capital. So I'm going to use this structure to value a bank. And it's a bank that I think of as one of those characters in a horror movie that keeps going back into the basement with the chainsaw loud there, and then blood comes spurting out. And it keeps doing it over and over again. It's Deutsche Bank. This is from a 2016 post. I'll send you the actual post. And I titled the post "A Greek Tragedy at a German Bank." And I chose the words deliberately. You know how the Germans always look down at the Greeks, right? They're so undisciplined. They can't run anything. And here you have the ultimate German institution behaving exactly the way the Greeks are supposed to behave, at least in German eyes. And let me set the table for why Deutsche was in trouble in 2016. Deutsche, if you go back 30 years, had these visions of becoming an investment bank. It grew strongly. And then 2008 came along and the bottom fell out. In fact, every bank was hurt by 2008, but Deutsche seemed to go back and get hurt over and over again. So every year after 2008, it kept losing, not just little money, but $1 billion, $1.5 billion, $2 billion. And you could throw in a trading loss in there to add to the losses. So every time you lose money, what happens to your book equity? It declines, right? Normally for a traditional company, say, who cares? But for a bank, when book equity declines, your regulatory capital is also going to get impacted. So the regulatory capital kept dropping, and they were in the danger zone already as they approached 2016. And in 2016, something happened that tipped them over the edge. The Department of Justice imposed a multi-billion-dollar fine on them for something they did in 2008. Now, what does that mean? That fine also comes out of book equity. So you take all of this money out of book equity, their tier one capital ratio, and you could pick any one of these capital ratios. It's really banking lingo. One goes down, the other goes down as well. Tier one capital ratio starts with book equity. And in my view, should stop at book equity, but bankers allow these little loopholes. If you have debt that looks like equity, we'll let you count it in. But the reality, it's residual claims. That ratio is down to 12.15%. Your first reaction is to look at that ratio. And let's be honest, most of us don't sit around thinking about tier one capital ratios. It's not healthy. So when you look at that ratio and say, what does that even mean? The only way to get a frame of reference, and this is what I did when I valued Deutsche, is to compute that ratio for every bank in the world. Sounds like a lot of work, but remember you have that S&P capital IQ. S&P capital IQ is tier one, tier two. It's got every number. So doing this is a 5-minute job. So it looks like it's more work, but I computed that ratio across all banks. Now, if you look at money center banks, because they're in riskier businesses like investment banking, their tier one capital ratios need to be higher precisely for regulatory reasons. They're riskier investments. 12.15% was low relative to what typical money center banks operate, which is around the 75th percentile, which is like 15.67%. So already you can see the hole is being dug, right? They're at 12.41%. They need to be at 15.67%, and they need to get there. And I did this valuation with rumors floating around that Deutsche might be taken into receivership. Remember, with traditional companies, you talk about bankruptcy and default. With the bank, you can't do that because they're depositors. You can't liquidate a bank. That's why when banks get in trouble, what happens to them? They get acquired by another bank. You got to keep it in the system because deposits have to be honored. So you look at First Republic, even Silicon Valley Bank. Somebody's going to pick up the residue. They might get an incredible bargain. Credit Suisse, UBS might be getting a bargain, but you're picking up this trouble bank. And there was talk that might happen to Deutsche in 2016. Now, do you see why I call Deutsche a horror movie? What are we talking about right now? Now that Credit Suisse has gone under, what's the next European bank that's in the target zone? Looks like Deutsche is back in the basement again with the chainsaw killer. Maybe it'll come out, maybe it won't. Okay? But you could see that the, but to add to the problem, Deutsche was losing billions of dollars. It had a net loss of $8.9 billion in the most recent year coming into the valuation. And it didn't look like the losses would go away for the next 2 or 3 years. So not only are they undercapitalized, they're a money losing bank. So I put my optimist hat on. Let's face it, if you're a pessimist, you look at this and say, this is a basket case. I'm not touching this bank. And that might be a healthy reaction. But let's say you want to value the bank. You've got to put your optimist hat on. What does Deutsche have going for it? It still is one of the largest banks in Europe. It still has, at least in Europe, a significant bank, a set of branches. And even if there's no growth, if it gets back to health, it has a pathway to survive. And I'm going to be, you know, realistic on that. If it makes it back to health, my assumption is that the return on equity will go from negative to positive and will catch up to the cost of equity. In other words, in the long term, the best I'm hoping that Deutsche can do is make its cost of equity. So what about excess returns? But Deutsche, talking about excess returns sounds like an oxymoron. I mean, this is a bank that can't make money. So my and it's going to take time. So over the next 10 years, if you look at my return on equity, here's what you will see. My return on equity starts at minus 13.7%. And over time climbs to 9.44%. That's awfully precise, 9.44%, but that's my cost of equity in steady state. So as my return equity goes from negative to positive, my losses become profits. And then from that net income or net loss, I subtract out how much they will need to invest in regulatory capital to get back to health. So I have to dig them out of this minus 12.41% and dig them up to 15.67%. So you see each year my investment regulatory capital, and it has consequences. Let's take year one. My expected loss in year one is $5.1 billion. It's only $5.1 billion. You say, what do you mean only $5.1 billion? They lost $8.8 billion last year. I'm saying, okay, they're going to move in the right direction. They have an expected loss of $5.1 billion. But remember, they need to fix this tier one capital problem. Otherwise, the regulators are going to step in. So in year one, you'll notice that I have to make an investment in regulatory capital of almost $6.6 billion. You add those two numbers up. My expected free cash flow equity in year one for Deutsche is about $11.7 billion. What does that mean? What do I assume that Deutsche will have to do in year one for my going concern optimistic scenario to even work out? It'll have not just raise money, it has to raise fresh equity. And you know what banks think about issuing shares. There's no choice here. You have to raise fresh equity to survive. Then year two, more fresh equity has to be raised. In fact, collectively, they've got to raise about $15 billion over the next three years. Not because they're growing, but because of the hole that they've dug for themselves. And in this case, I am assuming they will be able to do that. What could intervene? First is if their depositors catch wind of the fact that they're in trouble and they start withdrawing deposits, there is no year two or year three. It's going to spin very quickly out of control. So you got to do this without panicking people, which is the deadly mistake that Silicon Valley Bank made. They knew they had to raise equity, but they then let that out before they actually raised the equity. They put the egg first and the chicken didn't come till later. And by then it was too late because people had panicked. You can see why with banks, this trust issue can very quickly start to unravel your valuation. But my optimistic case, I'm assuming they're going to be able to do that. And because they're Deutsche in 2016, if you told people Deutsche is going to be in receivership, they'd have laughed at you. This is a 150-year-old bank. No, Deutsche is not going on. It's a large bank. So those free cash flows equity reflect what the company will have to raise. Eventually, with my optimistic story, here's what happens in year three or year four, as my net income starts to come back and my tier one capital finally gets close to where I need to be, my cash flows turn positive. That free cash flow equity is my potential dividend. I'm replacing what the actual dividend is, which for Deutsche, thank God, was zero, with a negative free cash flow equity because they have to actually raise fresh equity to become a going concern. Those free cash flows to equity get discounted back at the cost of equity. And with banks, historically, I've used the same cost of equity for banks. Why? Because unlevering and relevering banks is a pain. And with Deutsche, I decided that was far too risky to do. Because you can have risky banks. And this is something that I should have probably known going into 2008. Pre-2008, my assumption was there can't be really risky banks because the regulators would have stopped it. Post-2008, I allow for the fact that you can have differences in risk. And the way I showed is I computed the implied cost of equity for every bank in the sample and went to the 75th percentile saying, this is a risky bank. I'm going to give them a high cost of equity. So here's the combination. I'm allowing for a recovery in income as negative return equity becomes positive. I'm allowing them to dig out of the hole and get their tier one capital caught up to where it needs to be. And I'm attaching a high cost of equity to this because I know it's a risky bank. And eventually, as they get to steady state, I allow it to go to the median cost of equity. That's where the 9.44% comes in. Lots of moving pieces in my story. But if they all hang together, what I get is a present value is about $22.97 per share in my optimistic story. Is there a chance the story could unravel? Of course there is. That chance in 2016, I estimate to be around 10%. Why is it so low? I'll be quite honest, if this had been a small bank with these numbers, I'd have attached a much higher likelihood of failure. Why? Because the regulators will step in, take... What the larger a bank gets, the more difficult it becomes to kind of force it out of business and get somebody to take it over. It's one thing to get First Republic acquired by somebody else. It's an entirely different problem trying to get Deutsche. So what's going to happen, right? They're going to put band-aids and patchwork because nobody has an incentive here to push it over the edge. Nobody. JP Morgan doesn't want First Republic to go under for selfish reasons, because once one bank goes under, you can see what happens, right? The next weakest comes in line. Nobody comes out of this as a winner. So the low probability reflects it. Could things change? If another bank gets into trouble, that failure rate starts to go up for this bank. And this is the problem with banks, is once one bank gets into trouble, so you're valuing banks, your failure rate has to go up across the board, because in a sense, you increase this risk of this trust loss spiraling out of control. Now, I looked at your DCFs and you should have got it back. If you haven't got it back, I don't know where it is, to be quite honest. It's 2,455 emails ago. So if you haven't got it back, send it again. I know there are a handful of you valuing banks, but most of you luckily have picked bigger banks. But if you pick a smaller bank, the valuation you do now will give you a lower value of equity than the valuation you did 3 weeks ago, even if every single number looks the same. Because in a sense, that's what a crisis does. It makes every bank more vulnerable to this trust failure, and then the whole thing starts to unravel. This was my 2008 lesson applied in 2009. What I'm now thinking about with Silicon Valley Bank is what would I have missed in a Silicon Valley Bank using this? And here's what I think I'd have missed. What's the original sin? We talked about this, that Silicon Valley Bank was guilty of, that caused them to kind of go into this. It wasn't that they made risky loans, or at least we don't know that that was the issue. That wasn't the, it was the fact that they had a duration mismatch, right? So what I'm trying to think of now, is there a way I can look at duration mismatches at banks? And that information is actually public, but it's kind of messy to dig up. And bring it into the analysis. How would I bring it in? I've got to bring it in either into the cash flows, the growth, or the risk, right? And to me, the most logical place to probably bring it in is to attach it to the cost of equity. So up till now, I've estimated cost of equity based on your tier one capital ratios. Are they low or high? And maybe I need to bring a second dimension in, that if you have a duration mismatch, I need to start using a much higher cost of equity with you as a bank. Because even if interest rates look good now, you're always one interest rate shock away from things starting to unravel. So any questions on banks, investment banks, insurance companies, because they all share the same characteristics. Yes. Because when you're in trouble as a bank, the big changes have to come. What do the regulators want? If you tell them, I'll make a 10-year plan and I'll make an equal installment each year, you know what the regulator is going to say, right? No, I need to see big changes immediately, because I can't wait 7 or 8 years. The nature of regulatory shortfalls is you got to make up most of it early. In fact, in some cases, if you have a regulator who's really strict, they might ask you to make up the whole thing next year. I actually didn't finish the story. The value per share I get with the failure rate is 2067. The stock was trading at 1333. Ask me the question. Why? I bought. And I mean, it's one of those things I look back and say, what was I thinking? I did, but I actually got lucky in the sense that they did a rights issue 6 months after I bought the stock for about $10 billion. It was a huge rights issue. Was that unexpected? What does the rights issue do? It raises equity by issuing shares at below. You look at the free cash flow at equity of minus 11 billion, you could see this coming. I thought they would issue traditional shares. They went with the rights issue, which is good because lower issuance costs. And they gave every shareholder in the company a chance to cash out. Because on a rights issue, you can either exercise the right or sell the right back for cash. I luckily picked the sell the rights back for cash. I did for all the wrong reasons, but thank God I did it because I cashed out on almost 2/3 of my investment. Doge is still hanging out in my portfolio. But at least I made 2/3 of my money back. And at this stage, it's more option than anything else. If something good happens, I'll take it and be icing on the cake. If something bad happens, because give me something else to abuse Deutsche over in future years. But if you're valuing a bank, again, the traditional model, dividend discount model, start with that. It might work for your bank. But I think we increasingly have to step away from that model simply because we've lost trust. And closure on financial service companies, we put them all into one bundle, but not all financial service companies are created equal. You're valuing a PayPal or a MasterCard. They are financial service companies, but they're not like banks. They're really payment processing companies. So I won't go into the detail, but it was 2 years ago, this company called Paytm, Indian payment processing company, went public. And I hadn't valued too many payment processing companies. I mean, I valued MasterCard and Visa a long time ago. But think of how a payment processing company's business works, right? Every time somebody does a transaction on the platform and spends money, you get a piece of that. It's called a take rate. Okay? So when you look across credit cards, go back, forget about fintech. Look at MasterCard, Visa, American Express. You use it at a restaurant. You use it with a merchant. You pay $100. What does a merchant get? He gets 97 out of the 198. That take rate.
Yeah.
Historically, if you look back in time, American Express had the highest take rate, which is the reason fewer stores and restaurants accept American Express, because you're giving up more. That take rate is 2.5% for MasterCard Visa. It could be as high as 4% for American Express. But if you look at the drivers of value here, it's how many transactions happen on your platform and what percentage of that do you get to keep as a business? So PayPal gets about 2.8% of the gross merchandise. You can look at Block and see what it keeps. But basically, that becomes a big metric. So in a value Paytm, I constructed my valuation by looking at gross merchandise value. And there's a story you can tell. Paytm is on 330 million phones in India. That's a big selling point. Look at how many people. So there's transactions going through. The only problem is they give away almost everything for free, which is when you look at their take rate, translates into a take rate of 0.6, 0.7%. It's one of the lowest take rates. Now, if they're a healthy company, what should they do? You got 330 million users, they're using transactions, your take rate is too low for you to survive as a business. I made the assumption they were run by sensible people. Hindsight, terrible assumption. Who would turn their attention away from their historical focus of adding users to the platform and actually focus on the take rate. And actually projected out that the take rate would improve, not to some immensely high number. I don't think they're going to make it to PayPal level numbers because in Asia, take rates tend to be lower. Alipay is the same issue, that over time, their take rate would improve from 0.7 to 2%. So rather than try to forecast revenues, which is an aggregated number, I forecast out the transaction value and the take rate. The product of those two gives a revenue. I'm telling a big story for Paytm, but my big story is built around monetizing their user base. And over time, as they monetize their user base and the take rate goes from a low to a high number, it translates into actually making money in cash flows. So I valued around 2,000 rupees per share when it came, went public. It was actually, the pricing was initially set at like 2,800. Eventually it kept slipping. Now it's trading at like 500 rupees per share. I get more emails about, hey, you screwed up on Paytm. No. The classic, clearly this shows that all valuations fail, but I look back at this. Clearly there is something I miss. And to me, the biggest failure in my valuation was assuming that Paytm was actually run by people who actually knew how to run a business. The problem is Paytm is run by people who think that the objective of a business is to have the most users you can have in your platform. And they seem almost unable to do the switch. I made the mistake of installing the Paytm app on my phone because I'd never used Paytm in my life. It's an Indian app, but I applied. Every day I started getting a dozen notifications from Paytm on free stuff I could get. And that kind of cuts to the heart of the problem here. They're so busy giving away free stuff and signing on more users that nobody at the company seems to have any sense of, hey, this is a business. We've got 330 million users already. For God's sake, can you take your eye off the user count and start thinking about the take rate? I thought they would do that. I was sadly mistaken. To me now, I'd still, I mean, if I don't own the shares because I couldn't even participate in the IPO, but if I own the shares, you know what my escape hatch is here? If you're a non-Indian company, let's say Indian financial service businesses are thrown open and you want to enter the Indian market, you know what I would do, right? If you're MasterCard, you want to grow your business in India among low-income users, just go buy Paytm. You're getting it at a bargain basement price. You get 330 million users, and hopefully you can take care of building the take rate. This is a company, the value of control is immense. If somebody can take over the company and take the attention away from user count. So if any of you are valuing payment processing companies, that include, PayPal, Block, MasterCard, Visa, American Express, start to look at take a look at their take rates. It's somewhere in their financial statements. You can see what the take rate is. Look at trend lines. American Express, one of the challenges they face is their premium take rate has been under challenge. So they've introduced lower take rate versions of the American Express card. So you can see that their premium model is going to, just like any other business, as you, over time your take rate declines, it's going to show up as lower cash flows if you don't fix the problem. So financial service companies, it's messier than regular companies, but I think it's worth the effort. And the problem here is to value a bank, you need to invest in understanding banking regulation. I know it's not the most fun thing to do. I don't see a way around it. So let's talk about valuing companies with intangible assets. I hate the word intangible. Accountants, they've always created two sets of rules, one for tangible assets, one. So they almost have intangible accounting versus tangible accounting. To me, ultimately, the value of an asset comes from what in a discounted cash flow world? It comes from the cash flows from that asset, right? I don't care whether it's physical or intangible. But it is true that the way the accounting is done for companies with intangible assets makes it difficult to grapple with the valuation. So let me ask you the four questions again with a company with intangible assets, a pharmaceutical company, and ask you, what are your cash flows from existing assets? And you give me your income statement and your financial statements. What's the biggest challenge I have? You've taken your biggest capex, treated as an operating expense. In other words, I have to go through your financial statements and redo them to actually get a sense of how much are you making, how much are you reinvesting? A lot more work, right? It's easier to deal with a manufacturing company where things are at least accounted for right. When I ask you, what's the value of growth? If I haven't done my homework of capitalizing R&D, remember the big advantage of capitalizing R&D is not that you change your cash flow last year, but it gives you a much better sense of not just how much you're reinvesting, but what kind of return you're making on your invested capital. Deciding whether there's value to growth, you almost have to do those adjustments. The risk, same thing, risk in your cash flows with intangible assets. You're looking at things like, when will my patent expire? The things that you might not worry with the manufacturing company. So the basic process of valuing companies doesn't change just because you have a company with intangible assets, but the way in which you get the information takes a lot more work because you have to redo the accounting. That's basically what you're doing. The income statement, the balance sheet are being redone because you don't trust the accountants. Now, I talk about companies with intangible assets. I'm talking about almost all of the technology companies. I think the accounting is just completely screwed up. All of the pharmaceutical companies. In fact, you could argue that this is a bigger issue, or this is the more the rule than the exception, that the accounting doesn't work. So when you look at companies with intangible assets, of course, we know what the accounting miscategorization is. You know, you see R&D being classified as an operating expense, but it's not just those companies, consulting firms, the cost of recruiting and training, everything we talked about in the context of R&D. So what I thought I would do is talk about what R&D adjustments are. So this is revisiting what we did. And in a sense, this might be late in the process telling you why we do it. So I took, this is Amgen. This was about 12 or 15 years ago, I valued Amgen. In the first column or the second column, you see the accounting numbers that Amgen reported. So the accountants are telling me that Amgen makes about $5.07 billion in operating income. They give me an invested capital. I adjusted for R&D. What does that mean? I capitalize R&D, which changes my income, my invested capital. And in the case of Amgen, when I did that, my numbers changed pretty dramatically. My operating income went from $5 billion to $7.4 billion. My invested capital jumped. You know why, right? Because all that capitalized R&D goes into my invested capital. I got something very unusual with Amgen. We'll talk about the significance of this. Their return on capital actually went up. For most companies, we capitalize stuff, but their operating income effect was far greater than the invested capital effect. The return on capital went up. Their reinvestment rate changed a little bit, but basically the numbers were very different. You're saying, so what? I actually did two valuations, and you can each of you use capitalized R&D in your valuation. You can try this out because it's just a yes, no, right? If you say, yes, I capitalize R&D, I adjust all the numbers. I did my valuation of Amgen first, doing the right thing, which in my view is capitalizing R&D, and then I turned off the R&D option, which means I'm going to value Amgen trusting the accounting numbers. You think I'm going to get the same value for Amgen? If I did, why waste my time, right? We do this because it's going to change the value. So I got the value per share. Take a look at the bottom line there. I get a value per share of $43 when I value Amgen using the accounting numbers. And I get a value of $74 when I capitalize R&D. It's great, right? So when you capitalize R&D, your value per share goes up. Is that always going to be true? Or let me rephrase the question. What is it that I'm learning about Amgen from looking at those two values, that when the value per share goes up and you capitalize R&D, what is it telling me about the type of R&D that Amgen is doing? In fact, R&D is like any other CapEx, right? It can be value adding, value neutral, or value destructing. You can have good R&D and bad R&D. When I capitalize Amgen and the value goes up, you know what I'm learning? That at least over their history, Amgen has done value creating R&D. What does that mean? They invest money in R&D or they expend it. They've converted into higher revenues and higher profits, and I'm capturing that effect on my value. I did the same thing for Merck at the time that I valued Amgen. In other words, I valued it without the R&D adjustment and with the R&D adjustment. And there the value per share went from $37 per share to $26 per share. In other words, capitalizing R&D pushed down the value. Why? Because Merck, at least over the period that I looked at them, had kept spending more money on R&D, but their income stayed flat, which meant that they weren't getting any payoff. The value went down because once I started treating R&D as a capital expense and said, this company is going to continue to do this, it brought down the value. So in short, when you capitalize R&D, the reason you're doing it is we want to make a judgment of, is this the kind of company where R&D is creating value or the kind of company where it's destroying value? And I think the answer to that question is critical, right? If you take a technology company and they're spending billions of dollars in R&D and you keep saying, that's good, I'm going to increase their value. And half of them are wasting that R&D. You're in fact pushing up value when you should be pushing down value. So when you capitalize in these expenses like R&D, that's effectively why you're doing it, is to capture that effect. So with intangibles, you don't have to do anything different, but You have to try to take expenses that are capital expenses that are being treated as operating expenses and do the switch. Let's move to commodity and cyclical companies. Take a mature commodity company. In fact, the last valuation I got came in this morning. It's a valuation of Aramco.
Yes.
Is Javier here? No? I don't know. This is as mature an oil company as you can get, right? Their operating income jumped by 40% between 2021 and 2022, and it's going to be up by 14% 2022 to 23. It was down, I think, 18% in 2020. That's not the way a mature company behaves, right? But what's causing the operating income for Aramco to be all over the place? It's oil prices. It's not that they're producing more or less oil. It's oil prices going up and down. You see where I'm going? Even the most mature commodity and cyclical companies will have volatile earnings. Their earnings will go up. So in any given year, you can see a 20% jump in earnings or a 15% drop because of what's happening. So every question I ask you about the company, there's a macro reason for why it's changing. And I ask you, what are your cash flows from existing assets? And you show me the last 10 years for ExxonMobil or Royal Dutch or Aramco, the numbers are going to be all over the place. But if you then put the oil price each year, you can see very quickly what's driving. It's driven by a macro factor. When I ask you, is there value added or destroyed by your oil exploration? If I ask you this question in March of 2020, when oil price was 32, almost everything you do is destroying value, right? At $100, everything is creating value. So you swing from, hey, this is a terrible company, this is an amazing company. And when you think about risk in these companies, and let's keep the ESG issue out, because that's going to also come into play here. The risk in these companies comes from the fact that as your oil prices go up and down, you can go from being a very safe company 1 year because oil price $100, and the same company 2 years later can be on the verge of disaster if oil prices drop to 30. I mean, let me cut the long story short. In fact, the final question about when will you be a mature company? With commodity companies, at least, there is this question you got to ask is there's a finite amount of that commodity on the face of the earth. So how can I assume a 2% growth rate forever when you're going to run out of oil or gold eventually? Maybe the argument is with commodity companies, we shouldn't be using perpetuities. We should have a finite period. When it's done, you run out. So with these companies, you can already see that there's a macro component driving the valuation, and it's almost a given. So even the most mature oil company, its fortunes are driven by oil prices. You know what you're going to be tempted to do then when you value Royal Dutch? Because oil prices are such a big factor, you're going to be tempted to play oil price prognosticator. For God's sakes, don't. Because I'll save you the trouble. Let's assume that you expect oil prices, it's your view, no, you've got this crystal ball you've looked at, to go up 15% a year for the next 5 years. I'll save you the trouble. Every oil company is going to look cheap to you. You think, so what? Then I'm going to follow up and ask you a question. Why is Royal Dutch looking cheap to you? Is it because you like the company or because you think oil prices will go up 15% a year? Why do I care what the answer is? If it's a ladder, what should you do? If you're that good at forecasting oil prices, what the heck are you doing valuing Royal Dutch? Go buy oil futures. You'll make a lot of money. If you're good at forecasting macro stuff, for God's sake, stop dealing with companies. You got an easier way to make money. And how good are prognosticators who forecast oil prices? They exist to make soothsayers look good. Why are you messing with this? And if you do, you can already see I have a problem. Every valuation do will be a joint effect of what you think about the company and what you think about oil prices. What you think about the company and what you think about the economy, it's cyclical companies. I'm going to make a suggestion that's really difficult to follow, and I have trouble following it. Try to be as macro neutral as you can be when you value a macro-driven company. So what am I telling you with oil, when you value an oil company? Take the price of oil as is. Don't play games with it. If you want to use market numbers for future oil prices, which you can sometimes get, but remember, futures oil prices are driven by arbitrage. It's spot oil price and storage costs. If you want to use those, fine, but don't bring in an expert's view on oil prices or your view on oil prices, because then you mess up two things in the same valuation. So I'm going to use an example to illustrate this, and it's a company so I'll come back to this. Is Royal Dutch, one of the oldest oil companies around, large integrated oil company. So this is a valuation I did of Royal Dutch in March of 2016 for their finance group in Houston. So, you know, I went in, they said, no, do you value Royal Dutch? At the time, oil prices had dropped significantly over the previous year from $70 down to $45. So as you look at this valuation, you're going to see my attempt to value Royal Dutch and be market macro neutral at the same time. I'm going to value Royal Dutch. It's a conditional valuation. I want to give you a valuation of Royal Dutch at a $45 oil price. Now, let me ask you a question. You value Royal Dutch at a $45 oil price. If oil prices go to 60, what's going to happen to the value? Going to go up and go to 30. So in a sense, I'm going to leave the oil price judgment out of it and say, given the oil price today, is Royal Dutch under overvalued? And it was actually really difficult to be macro neutral. Here's why. What do we usually start with as a base numbers? You look at the last 12 months, you look at revenues, operating income, cash flows. And what they said happened to oil prices over the previous year, they'd gone from $70 to $45, right? I have a problem here. The problem is, if I take the trailing 12-month numbers, I will overvalue the company. Does everybody see why? Because those trailing 12-month numbers reflect an oil price of $70. If oil price of 45, I'm going to find the company undervalued if I just plug the numbers into an Excel spreadsheet. I would love to know what Royal Dutch's revenues and profits would be if oil price were actually 45. In other words, I don't want to look at the trailing 12 months. And here, there's a way you can do this, and at least with mature oil companies, you can try this. Here's what I did. I looked at Royal Dutch's revenues over time. It's been around forever. So these are the columns are the Royal Dutch revenues each year. The brown line is actually oil prices each year, average oil prices. Do the two look like they move together? There's a 96% R squared. Now, in fact, at the presentation, somebody asked me, do you know who Royal Dutch's CEO is? And I said, I don't know, and I don't care. What's he going to do anyway? Come in and look at the terminal a little more carefully? This is a pure oil price play. But there's the other advantage from this graph. I ran a regression of revenues at Royal Dutch against the oil price. You're saying, what's that going to tell me? Take a look at the coefficient of the regression, 4,039.3. What does that tell me? Every $1 increase in oil prices increases my revenues by $4 billion. It's effortless, but cuts the other way as well. Now, what's the question I was trying to answer? At a $45 oil price, what would Royal Dutch's revenues be, right? You plug in a $45 oil price into that regression, you're going to get a predicted revenue for Royal Dutch given oil prices of $45. Basically, it allows me to become macro neutral by bringing in the oil price. And that's what I used. We go back to the previous page as my base year revenues is not the revenues from the trailing 12 months, but the revenue. I'm sorry, it was a $40 oil price. The revenues at a $40 oil price. So I've lowered the revenues from the actual revenues, not because I want to punish the company, but you can see how it can cut the other way as well, right? Let's say that you're valuing an oil company in early 2021. You look at the last 12 months, they're going to look horrifically bad because you had COVID and oil prices dropped to $30 a barrel. But rather than use the trailing 12-month numbers, I'm going to look at the $60 oil price you saw already by 2021 and estimated revenue. And for a company like ExxonMobil and Royal Dutch and Aramco, you're going to see the relationship you saw with Royal Dutch play out. So I finished the valuation. I come up with a value of about 39. The stock is trading at 42. And of course, people are saying, aren't you uncertain about the oil price? I said, of course I am. And you're uncertain as well. Nobody's certain about the oil price. But so what? We're uncertain about lots of things. And he said, would value be affected? Absolutely. And if you have something that's hanging over your valuation that's making you uncomfortable, you're taught to do two things, right? What if questions. And it's kind of useless here to ask what if questions, because here's what the what if questions are going to look like. If oil prices go up, the stock's worth a lot. If oil prices go down, they're not worth very much. Thank you for letting me know, but not much is learned, right? So here's the last thing I did. Now I use crystal ball, this add-on to Excel that you can get us. What's the one number in this valuation that I'm uncertain about? It's the oil price, right? I know the current price is 40, but I can know it can go to 60, it can go to 20. I made it a distribution based on the history of oil prices. So rather than do one valuation, I said, look, I'm uncertain about the oil price. You're uncertain about the oil price. I'm not going to take a point of view on oil prices because I'm not good at forecasting oil prices. But I do know that oil prices will change. So in a simulation, here's what you do. You go pluck a number out of the distribution. Let's say the first number you come up with is $53. Because in the distribution, that's feasible. I value Royal Dutch at 53. I come up with a much higher value. Second one, $36. I get a lower value. And I repeat this over and over again. The default in crystal ball is 10,000 simulations. And each time you run one, you get a value. And at the bottom, I've actually, bottom right-hand corner, I've actually a distribution of value at Royal Dutch. And you're saying, what do I do with that? If I take the average value across the distribution, I get roughly the same value that I got with my base case valuation, saying I wasted my time to find that. But I can also give you a distribution. I can say this is the first quartile. This is so at the time that I did, the stock was trading at 42. It was trading at roughly the 62nd or the 63rd percentile there, because you look at the distribution. Which means that at its current price, I can say there's a 63% chance it's overvalued, a 37% chance it's undervalued. Think like a portfolio manager. Rather than give you a price and a value for every company, think about me giving you a distribution, and then you can impose your own rules. I will buy a stock only if it's at the 40th percentile or below. I will sell a stock once it gets above the 75th percentile. You now have more information to make your decisions. Why haven't we always done this? 30 years ago, to run a Monte Carlo simulation would have cost you millions of dollars. You needed a mainframe computer, and you needed somebody who would actually program it for you. Today, it's free for you. Every one of your valuations, you can convert into a Monte Carlo simulation. So you can take your valuation, add crystal ball, and that revenue growth margin and sales to capital number that you were so that made you so uncomfortable, and it should, right? You're uncertain. You can make each of those numbers into a distribution. Of course, the only thing is it's garbage in, garbage out. So if you pick random distributions and random parameters, you'll get great looking output, but it's still garbage. So you're going to do this. It will mean that you can't just tell me you're uncertain. You got to start to put some numbers around. This is how uncertain I am. This is a high number. But it's useful. That, I think, is the healthy way to deal with uncertainty. Look it in the face. Make your best estimates. And at least now it's not a point number. You can give me a distribution and come up with a distribution of value. So I'm going to leave you with that. And on Wednesday, we will be starting on packet two. There are a few more pages here that I want to complete, but we'll start with packet two. So make sure you print off packet two and bring it with you to class.
I had a lot of discussions about how to correlate in my last job, and I came to the conclusion that correlating prices seem a little bit weird because they're not independent with each other. They're like autocorrelation. Yeah, they're always overstated.
Are you talking about time series correlation? Or
yeah.
It doesn't matter if the prices are out of correlation, right? If your income jumps or not, it's got nothing to do with price. You're still going to, even if there's auto correlation in price levels, if your income is not related to price, you're still going to get a low correlation in revenues and income. But this is a correlation across two variables, right? So unless you can show me that the auto correlation to price is automatically driving autocorrelation revenues. Still have two variables. So having an autocorrelation in one of the two variables doesn't stop you from computing. Autocorrelation becomes an issue if you use a time series to forecast in the future. Because you're
not forecasting this.
I'm not forecasting. I'm just trying to find the relationship. If you're forecasting autocorrelation, because it exaggerates your power to forecast the future. The correlation number is too high because over the time series, it looks like you're forecasting power, and all you're doing is catching that
you know, year to year changes are correlated with each other.
But why not correlate the return then? Isn't there more robust
return? Look at I have a very singular task. I want to forecast revenues at a $40 oil price. I'm not trying to decide whether oil companies are good investments or bad investments. That's a different question, right? That I would add, you know, run the regression differently. I would have a lagged effect.
All right. Okay.
Yeah, because I can't observe the oil price and go back and invest in that here. So if I want to see, are oil companies good or bad investments after oil prices have gone up or after oil prices have gone down, then I can run a very different kind of analysis. Look at returns on oil companies and regress them against oil price change the previous year.
Right, and see if there's alpha.
And
right.
see if there's a link. And if there's a link, then ask, you know, is this a potential way for me to make money? Because it looks like, you know, buying oil companies right after oil prices have dropped delivers higher returns than buying oil companies after they've peaked. But that would require that there you would use returns because you're asking and answering a very different question. Here it's a contemporaneous regression. All I'm asking is, when oil prices change, what happens to Royal Dutch's revenues? And the answer here is almost everything that happens to its revenues is coming from oil prices changing because it's a mature oil company. The correlation is going to be low when you take a young oil company because their production, you know, the number of barrels of oil you're changing. So basically each year, everything else is also changing because you're exploring more, you're bringing new fields online. There, the correlation will be lower, and there it's more difficult to forecast out what the revenues would be if, you know, the oil price were $40 instead of $60.
Mm-hmm. Okay, makes sense.
I wanted to know what's the
crystal ball. You turn the software, then when you turn software,
it's more, you can't make sense of that crystal ball.
You can't, because we're going to do it. You can buy it from Oracle. Seven. So if you're going to buy it as a student, it's $100. Or you want to keep it, buy it. They have different programs. You can buy a legacy which stays on, but you get no upgrades, or you can get an upgraded version. So.
Or you can just have a
original.
No, but he's asking once you start being a student, you can access it in the school or off campus. Yeah, but you have to do the NYU. You have to go to books. PC.
I have
programs. You also then have to run. Version of Excel
was that
so you don't have to install PC Excel on your Mac, but you have to stay in the PC Excel there, run the crystal ball in there, and then you can export it. That the output, you can remember your crystal ball is an add on, so if you're not adding parameters, you're taking your existing parameters and making them distributions.
Yeah,
and you can have as many distributions as you want. You can have only one output there. Mm-hmm. You can have as many input distributions. It allows you to put in correlations across the distribution for all of those things. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Okay. Okay.
Any other questions?
Yeah.
So the PayTM.